Welcome to this segment of A Day at DPL, a thought leadership series that is part of the Advisor Revelations podcast. You will hear from DPL's founder and CEO, David Lau, and a special guest where they will discuss educational topics around industry trends and best practices, providing advisors insights to grow your business and better serve clients.
Hello, Daniel Crosby. And welcome to the podcast. Terrific to have you on. Very exciting. Your area of expertise is a topic I find fascinating and really, you know, frankly, underappreciated in my humble opinion. And so let me do a quick intro for Dr. Daniel Crosby. I'm sure many of you know Daniel and his work. Daniel is the Chief Behavioral Officer at Orion. In this role, he develops behavioral tools, training, and technology for financial advisors to allow the practical application of behavioral science, which is really important. So it's one thing to understand, appreciate, study. It's another thing to be able to apply. So Daniel, again, welcome. And maybe you can talk a little bit about your role at Orion and how you got there and some of the things you're working on.
Yeah, for sure, David. Good to be with you. And thanks for the nice words about me and about behavioral finance broadly. I'm deeply biased, but do think it's the most interesting and perhaps the most important part of the work that we all do. I'll start with how I got here briefly, and then we can talk about what I'm doing. I actually trained to be a psychotherapist. I mean, my PhD is in clinical psychology. I went to school to be a shrink. But, you know, about 3 or 4 years into my program, I was really candidly starting to burn out. I started doing therapy when I was the ripe old age of 23. And I'm not sure what wisdom a 23-year-old has to impart on the world about how to live a life, but that's what I was doing. And I started to burn out. I mean, I was just working with a very sort of heavy caseload of people with very heavy problems. And I wanted to look for a different application of this work. And I came to my dad, who is a great friend and sort of career counselor for me, and said, hey, look, I love thinking deeply about why humans do the things that they do, but I don't know that I want to do it in a medical context. And my dad, who was and is a financial advisor, said, well, hey, there's a lot of psychology in my world, so maybe you could, you know, maybe there's something for you there. Now, my dad, who's a wirehouse advisor in Alabama, did not, you know, 15 years ago know the words behavioral economics or behavioral finance, but he did have this sense that there was opportunity there. And he understood personally that much of the work that he did was driven by an understanding of human behavior. So long story short, that comment from him set me on a path of exploration and discovery and hard work that sort of landed me where I am today. And at Orion, do a couple of things. First, a great deal of sort of public outreach. I have a podcast called Standard Deviations, where we teach people about how to bring these things to their clients. I do a great deal of public speaking on behalf of Orion. But we also develop tools in-house. You know, we have a suite of behavioral finance tools where we bake behavioral best practices into the way that advisors work with their clients. And we have an advisor academy, the Orion Advisor Academy, where we give free CE to advisors who want to learn about applied behavioral finance.
Yeah, I imagine they're quite popular right now with, you know, all the volatility going on in the market. And I think your dad, you imparted some, you know, pretty practical wisdom and observation that I've heard from financial advisors for the decades that I've been, you know, working with advisors, in that particularly in times like this, in times of volatility, they feel like they're playing more of a role of a, you know, psychologist than a financial advisor. And while, you know, many wouldn't put the words behavioral finance to it, they certainly relate to how impactful that can be to a client and their financial outcomes. And I know you've spent a lot of time on that, and you have some great guidance for some rules around thinking about it.
Yeah.
So the tools that you have at Orion, what are, you know, a couple of the most popular? And are there any that are super hot right now, given the market dynamics?
Yeah. So the most utilized, I'll talk about the most utilized and then I'll talk about my favorite. How's that? So the most utilized is a goals-based wealth management platform called Protect Live Dream. And it's based on the science of mental accounting. So we know from the psychological literature that people engage in this thing called mental accounting, which is basically just bucketing or enveloping our money. We bucket our accounts in our minds and we treat money differently depending on how we've accounted for it in our minds. So if something is earmarked for, you know, for retirement, we don't want to spend it on medical bills. And if something is earmarked for vacation, we're loath to spend it on milk and eggs. So this happens whether we want it to or not. We, our clients are always sort of mentally accounting for their different tranches of money, even though that's candidly kind of irrational. A dollar is a dollar is a dollar, right? Like money's fungible, but that's not how people think about money. And so what we do with Protect Live Dream is we're just very intentional about that process of bucketing a piece of it for safety, bucketing a piece of it to live your life, and bucketing a piece of it for aspiration, because people have multiple simultaneous risk preferences. Rationalist economic theory says, you know, we should be able to plot a single risk preference for a single person. But, you know, crazy folks like you and I, David, we buy insurance and lottery tickets. We want to insure against low levels of wealth, but we also want to take a flyer on potentially life-changing big ticket stuff like a small business or a risky stock. So what we're doing is understanding and sort of speaking to these multiple simultaneous risk preferences all at once while maintaining an overall picture that still makes sense for the client. So that's our most utilized, our most popular tool.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. And probably if you've been utilizing that approach and that tool with your clients, they probably are not as amped up in today's market because they've got that framework to think about.
So you're exactly right. So if you go, you know, in my book, The Soul of Wealth, I cite the power of taking the worst case off the table. And what the safety bucket does, what sort of a dedicated sleeve of safety assets does, is during a time like this, when your clients are calling you up and saying, are we going to have a recession? Are we in a bear market? And I mean, you rightly have to say, I don't know, and I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the only honest answer. But you can say this, like, look, the average bear market with a recession is about 18 months in length, has an average drawdown of about 30 to 35%. And so let's say we are, right? Like, let's just take the worst case. Let's say we are in a recession and we could expect a 33% drawdown and two tough years. Well, we have a safety bucket here. We knew there would be days like these. We have this safety bucket here. You're good. We have 2 years of safety here for you. You can ride out the storm and come out the other end okay. And in the book, I cited an observational study where people who had those dedicated safety assets were 10 times less likely to go to cash and make sort of a sweeping change to their portfolio when the advisor could point to that. So even though, again, money's fungible and money is money is money, if you've dedicated a certain sleeve or a certain product to this pursuit of safety and you have something to point to when your clients come in worried, it can do a great deal for their peace of mind.
It's such a super interesting topic to me because, you know, we play a role into that with what we're bringing. Like you said, people like insurance and they like lottery tickets, which is an interesting way to think about it. But like in my time in financial services and working with advisors or individuals, the safety part of the investment, like the actual investment into safety, it's been challenging. It used to be years ago, you had stocks and bonds, and stocks were the risk on, bonds were the risk off, and you know, they were inversely correlated. And so during early years of investing, you were heavily loaded into stocks and less into bonds. And then that shifted and kind of inverted, you know, as you approached retirement. And today, that over really the last almost two decades, that's been really challenging as we've seen bonds be really correlated to stocks. And so the notion of how do you get to safety for an investor has been more problematic, I think, you know, from a tactical point of view, you know, for financial advisors. And that's part of where, you know, we can come into and bringing insurance products that have downside protection or guarantees for income, which can be super helpful. And what's fascinating to me is often when advisors, I've spoken to them about this topic of effectively behavioral finance, they're always talking about their clients. And it's like, I wish my clients were calmer, you know, during the storm. I wish they could just stay the course. I tell, you know, I hear those words all the time. They can just stay the course. Well, part of it is having them in the right portfolio, the one that matches to their psychology. And how do you think about that? And, you know, how does the advisor play that role in understanding how to build investments around a client's psychology?
So this is one of my favorite topics, and it will allow me to introduce a framework that I developed that I feel strongly about. So there's sort of three legs to this stool of how you bring about the sort of behavior that these advisors are talking about, which is, of course, what every advisor wants and what every investor needs. The first leg of the stool, they all start with E to make them memorable. The first leg of the stool is education. So I can't remember what the market's down 1% this morning or something, but you know that brings us to 11 or 12% down for the year, right? The average intra-year drawdown over the last 35 years has been about 14.5%. So in one way of speaking, what we're experiencing now is completely normal. And yet, the way that the news acts, you would think that every 10% tumble in the market is a wholly unprecedented thing.
Recency bias.
Yeah, like that could speak to the end of times. You know, one of the things that advisors need to do is educate their clients. That's that first leg, so that they're a little bit of a financial historian to say, look, you should assume that every year, like as regularly as your birthday, you're going to get a 10 to 15% drop in the markets every year. Like every year that we work together, this is going to happen. It's no big deal. And help them to expect that, because the media doesn't treat it as the enormously regular thing that it is. And so, you know, again, other lessons about just how do markets work is one thing that empowers the investors to make it through times like these and go, oh, we've been here before, right? And these tend to be buying opportunities, and this kind of happens a lot. The second piece is the most overlooked, and it's the one that you are talking about. So if the first leg of the stool is education, the second leg of the stool is environment. This is probably my biggest learning of my two decades of being a student of human behavior, is that environment is a better predictor of behavior than desire or values, right? And you think about this across a number of contexts. Like I did in the last year, I've lost a bunch of weight. And one of the ways that I did that was by shaping my environment, right? And you do simple things. Like if you don't want to eat Oreos, you just don't buy Oreos, right? You know, instead of white knuckling your way past a bag of double stuffed Oreos, you just don't bring them in the house. You make your environment better. If you want to work out in the morning, the research shows that laying out your gym shoes and your shorts and your t-shirt, as simple as that is, like that environmental stimulus greatly improves your likelihood of going to the gym. So there's all these environmental cues that I've tried to tweak in order to get in better shape, and it's worked. The same thing is true of investors. If we want our investors to be calm, if we want them to take the ride in the way that we want them to be able to stay the course, we have to design portfolios in ways that maximize anxiety-adjusted returns. What do I mean by that? I think a lot of times we compute something that is spreadsheet optimal, right? You know, the math is optimal, but it doesn't take the human and put the human in the loop. The optimal portfolio for your clients is not the one that on paper gives them the highest returns. The optimal portfolio for your clients is the one that they can live with for 20, 30, 40 years and see through to the end. And not enough advisors have come around to that way of thinking yet.
100%. I think that's just so important. You know, so many advisors, they just think about, again, what is like mathematically the best thing? What does research tell us the optimal portfolio for returns, you know, risk-adjusted returns are? It's like, well, that's great. And you should start there, right? So, but not every client can bear that. And there's something I want to talk about related to that, but I want to get to your third E before jumping into it.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'll riff on that for a minute. You know, back to my diet and exercise program over the last year, one of the reasons why this one stuck where others I've tried have failed is because I baked in some imperfection. One of the things that I do is 80% of the time, or, you know, 80% of my calories are good stuff, like high protein, fruits, veggies, fiber, you know, all that good stuff. But every night at 8 o'clock, I plan, it's usually a Snickers bar, sometimes it's Reese's Cups. But like when I get up in the morning and I'm entering all my macros, I go, you know, hey, I'm eating a Snickers bar at 8 o'clock because it's been a long day and like I earned it and whatever. There's not a nutritionist on earth that would say, hey, you know, that Snickers bar is the optimal choice for your 8 o'clock snack. I mean, there's better things I could be eating. But that little piece of humanity, right, that little piece of humanity is what allows me to do all the other stuff and not feel like I'm being deprived. So that's a really important concept, I think, for advisors to grasp. The last E is sort of the last line of defense, and it's what a lot of advisors are doing now, and it's encouragement, right? Even for someone who's been educated, even for someone who's in a sensible portfolio, there's just going to come moments where it's scary. And I mean, look, I think we're in one in a very real way. This is kind of a weird time we're going through. It's sort of unprecedented. The causes of it are sort of unusual, and people rightly have concerns and they have questions. And there are moments where the advisor needs to encourage their clients. And there's sort of an art and a science to having those conversations as well that I talk about a lot. But if you do those three things, right, if you educate your clients on the front end and sort of inoculate them against the things that markets do, if you have them in the right environment, if you have them in a portfolio that is reported out and segmented and allocated in a way that they can take the ride, and then if you're working on your interpersonal skills and your bedside manner so you can encourage them when things do get tricky like they are right now, I think those three legs of that stool maximize the likelihood that your client's going to be okay.
Yeah. And I think in my humble, undoctoral education of those things, I find the middle E, the environment, to maybe be the most important because, you know, being educated and having that encouragement, it is a lot more effective when I'm in an environment that I'm comfortable with. And I've seen this in a number of different ways, one of them being very personal, where my father attempted to retire several times over, actually did retire, but just didn't stick for a little while. Because ultimately, in talking to him when he was finally going to retire again for the last time, I was like, is this really going to stick this time? I wasn't sure if he was just a workaholic, because I know he's always loved work. But it turned out it was much more related to behavioral finance. And he was with, you know, a good advisor that I had recommended to him, a really good firm. And one of the issues he had was just about his retirement income. And he's like, I've been saving my whole life. I've been getting a paycheck my whole life. And now I've got this plan, which doesn't feel like a plan to me. He's a doctorate of physics and MBA. And so like he's definitely into plans. And he's like, it feels like a set of rules that we might try to work on, but it doesn't feel like a solid plan. And there's so much change, I can't get comfortable with it. And I said, Dad, you know what I do. You know what an annuity is. It's going to give you a regular paycheck and kind of replicate some of the behavior you're used to your whole life, getting that budgeting paycheck and, you know, the ability to spend and know, have certainty around your income. And that literally changed it for him. It went from he was very nervous about retirement to he's very comfortable in his retirement. He doesn't worry about the markets. Having that, and it was really just a behavioral thing, not an economic thing as much, but knowing he's getting that regular paycheck, it's going to last his life, it's going to cover his essential expenses, was a huge difference for him.
Yeah, again, that's the mental accounting thing. The reason people love annuities, the reason people love dividends and like all these things, it feels like a paycheck. And, you know, an economist can sit there and try and describe to someone that, hey, look, a dividend and a capital expenditure are really the same thing. And, you know, the stock is decreased by the level of the dividend. It doesn't matter. Like, it feels like a paycheck to me. I miss my paycheck. And that's, I think, again, where we as an industry get it wrong sometimes. We are trying to, you know, push our glasses up our nose and explain to people, you know, the irrationality of our preference for dividends. Instead of just going, look, if this allows you to retire and it makes you sleep well at night, then fine, whatever. This is fine.
Yeah. And one of my favorite examples to point out, and I wrote a couple of opinion pieces, one in Bloomberg and one in Wall Street Journal, was a few years ago as COVID was hitting and the markets were tanking and going, you know, a bit haywire, Bill Bangin had an article in the Wall Street Journal. Bill Bangin, for those who don't know, the father of the 4% rule, you know, the safe withdrawal rate within retirement, announced in the Wall Street Journal that he had moved to 10% equity. I believe this is right. 10% equities and, you know, 20% fixed income and 70% cash. And if you know what the 4% rule is, it requires that you stay at least 60% in equities in order to maintain that safe withdrawal rate. And he basically said the markets are at a place that I can't stay in them in his retirement. I think he was about 10 years into his retirement. And if the father of the 4% rule can't stick to the 4% rule, in terms of what it requires and how you're invested, then how is an average client going to do that? So obviously a very highly educated person on investing and risks and staying the course and all that just couldn't emotionally or however do it in his own retirement. I thought that was absolutely fascinating and really should be very instructive to financial advisors as they try to work with their clients and setting up the right environment.
Yeah, it's a great story, David. This is what psychologists call the knowing doing gap. And we, you know, we see it absolutely everywhere. My favorite, I mean, it's kind of sad, but it is my favorite example, is that nurses smoke at about double the rate of the general population. And if you ask 100 RNs, hey, who smoke cigarettes, like, hey, is smoking cigarettes good for you? You know, I mean, not a single one of them would tell you yes. But, you know, they just, their jobs are hard. They work weird hours. Their jobs are hard. What are you going to do? Like, they, that's why they smoke. It's not because they think it's good for them. And, you know, all of us do this in different parts of our lives, right? We don't do the thing that we know to do or that we know would make us happier or fitter or wealthier just because it's hard. And, you know, you see this with Harry Markowitz did a very similar thing. There's this great story about him, you know, the sort of the father of the optimal portfolio and pioneering diversification and all the math behind diversification. They asked him how he allocated his assets. And he said 50% stocks, 50% bonds, because he didn't want to feel bad on missing out. And yet, you know, I do this myself. I mean, it's the reason I've written 4 books on behavioral finance. And if I gave the world access to my accounts, they wouldn't be, I'm not sinless in this whole thing, right? I mean, I've panicked. I've done silly things myself. And it's one of the reasons why I pay an advisor. I mean, I pay my father good money to manage my account because I know that even though I am a quote unquote expert in these things, it's one thing to give other people advice. It's a very different thing to take your own advice. I'm a huge advocate for every advisor should work with an advisor. If you, when you see that the point of this whole thing is behavioral primarily in nature, I think it's smart for even experts to work with experts.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things for me in doing what I do has been, it's always about the end consumer, whether it's been in companies I've built that have worked directly or like DPL we do through advisors. But, you know, trying to deliver better outcomes for consumers. That's been like my whole career. And part of it is at DPL, it's the product structure of eliminating commissions, you know, in annuities and providing much better value and making them, taking away the conflicts of interest and all the issues advisors have with them. And one of the cool things, you know, I think, because as you were pointing out, annuities have so many positive psychological benefits and behavioral benefits to clients, both in accumulation, where they can get some downside protection, and in retirement. They're products that you should be educated about as an advisor. And one of the neat things we did about a year and a half ago, is we survey our advisors and ask them, and these are RIAs, the only advisors who've never used annuities, how has annuities impacted your, using annuities impacted your business and your clients? And they repeat back like to us in the surveys, the things that researchers like you would tell them. But they said, oh, we've seen that, you know, our clients stay the course more. You know, they're less worried during times of, you know, market volatility. They're able to take more income in retirement because they've got the certainty of income. They don't worry about outspending their assets. You know, so you see all these neat psychological benefits repeated back, which is, you know, really rewarding when you see, okay, you know, these people have opened their minds to using products that aren't traditionally used by RIAs because they're delivering better outcomes, you know, for clients. And I think that's super cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
One of the things, a couple of things I wanted to get to before we wind up wrapping up, but what are, you know, some of the big mistakes that people make in times like this? And are there ways advisors can communicate and talk and try to help prevent them?
Yeah. There's a good news, bad news here. The bad news is there's over 200 now identified cognitive biases. Like there's over 200 ways you can screw it up. And, you know, that's not very heartening, right? It's not very easy for advisors to remember 200 things. It's not very encouraging to tell your clients, like, look, there's 200 ways you can mess this up. But what I've done, one of the hallmarks of my work is I took that universe and I sort of distilled it down into what I call these meta biases. Now, these are the big ones, right? These are the ones where sort of one broad tendency accounts for many handfuls of smaller biases. The first of these is, there's four. The first of these is ego. Ego is the various forms of overconfidence, but it takes a number of forms. It's, you know, thinking we can see the future when we can't, thinking we're better than the average person, thinking the rules don't apply to us, thinking we're wiser than we are. And what this tends to do is it manifests itself in a couple of ways, right? Shunning advice. Ego says, hey, I'll just use E-Trade. Like, I don't need an advisor. I'll just do Robinhood or E-Trade or whatever. Like, I, you know, I don't need advice. Like, I can figure this out for myself. It also manifests in things like overtrading or being excessively active or jumping in and out of your account too much, doing too much, which we see, it's been studied in 19 different countries. And we know that the more people trade, the more people they mess with their account, the worse they tend to do in every country where it's ever been studied. So the various forms of ego or overconfidence is a big one. The second one is emotion. So emotion is just what it sounds like. It's confusing your, you know, your heart with your head and sort of leading with your gut or your intuition. And the research around emotion is really interesting because emotion in many decisional contexts serves us really well. If you are on a date with someone and they kind of give you the creeps, they're probably creepy. Like you probably shouldn't see them again. You should probably trust that. And there's many other contexts where intuition serves us very well because we have many reps. Every day, you and I are meeting lots of people and we're evaluating their interpersonal characteristics and we're learning whether or not they're trustworthy. Like that's something we do a lot of and we get pretty quick feedback on that. But in markets, the decisions are much more infrequent. The intuition is much less reliable. And it often is even the opposite of what it should be. You know, Howard Marks calls this the perversity of risk. That basically the moment of, you know, if you look at like March of 2009, one of the greatest outflows of all time, and that was the absolute bottom of the market, that was then, you know, followed up by a generational multi 15-year bull market effectively. And so often what we feel and what we should do with respect to our money sit 180 degrees from each other. So emotion is the second one. And it's hard to overcome those emotions. The third one is attention. Attention is our tendency to confuse things that are loud with things that are likely. And one example of this that's very sad is 9/11. So if you look at 9/11, thousands of people perished, right? Thousands of people perished in the World Trade Center and in the Pentagon. And every year we remember those people, we honor those people, and that is exactly as it should be. But there was many thousands more people died between September and December of that year in a way that was hidden from us because of the nature of how we think. And it was the very small decision to drive to a destination that they normally would have flown to. because in the wake of 9/11, it's this loud thing, right? This scary, loud, unexpected terrorist act that is very top of mind. And it's very scary. It was weird. I'm sure you remember the first time you got on a plane after 9/11, you were like, this is a little, I'm thinking twice about this in a way that I don't usually.
Because the planes were empty.
Yeah. I mean, the planes were empty. So people were driving something that's 5 or 6 hours away that normally they would have flown to. They decided to drive thinking it was safer. Well, what they did was confuse something that was loud with something that was likely. Because from a probabilistic perspective, even accounting for terrorist acts and things that are very unusual, very headline risky, driving in a car is a great deal more dangerous than driving to the grocery store in your car is more dangerous than flying to Japan on a plane. It just is. And so people looked at things that were loud instead of things that were likely. So attention bias has to do with a lot to do with our media diet. What kind of information are we taking in? What are we consuming? And at times like these, it becomes easy to doom scroll. It becomes easy to confuse staying informed with being wildly pessimistic. And that attention bias can lead us to make some really bad missteps. And then the final one is conservatism. Conservatism is our preference for the status quo. It's our preference for the known, for confusing things that we know with things that are good. You know, the U.S. has had a rough start to the year, and that's been extra damaging for people, for most investors, because the average U.S. investor is way over allocated to U.S. stocks because they know U.S. stocks. And we confuse things that we know with things that are good. And that's, not always the case. So you see people way over invest in their home country, people way over invest in their home industry and in their corporate stock. You know, people will over invest in company stock pretty dramatically. So it pays to, you know, get out there and not be so provincial in our thinking. So those are the big four: ego, emotion, attention, and conservatism.
Cool. So just to wrap up on two quick notes. One, you mentioned quickly, you've got a new book out. So let you plug that. But I want to ask you, like, when's the first time you realized you wanted to write a book? Were you like 6 years old and thought you might ultimately be an author someday? Or how did that all come about?
No, it's a funny story. I definitely did not want to write a book. I mean, I guess every six-year-old wants to write a fun book. But I really write. This is, you know, an adult phenomenon for me. I started doing this nearly 15 years ago, but I found that I had to write to figure out what I think. You know, I'm put in a position like this podcast, right? I'm put in a position where I'm asked about my opinion on any number of things, and people are assuming by virtue of my position and the letters after my name that I know what the heck I'm talking about. And the thing about working in psychology, human behavior is tricky, and people will ask you, you know, why do people do this? Why do people do that? And I mean, the reasons why people do the things they do are varied and hard to pin down sometimes. So I really started writing as a way to root out my own bad thinking and to figure out what I believe. Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winning physicist, has this great thing he called the Feynman technique. And it's basically like, if you want to find the holes in your thinking, try and teach it to a novice. And that's effectively what writing is, you know, especially if you're writing for a mass audience, like my new book, The Soul of Wealth, is written for a general audience. If you want to find, you know, I have three children. And, you know, my kids will ask me something about, you know, the three branches of government or why is the sky blue or something. And you go, oh, I don't really know that. You know, I just sort of have a hand wavy, weak answer and I have to dig in. So that's what writing does for me. And I think for you and for everyone, if you want to be humbled, try and teach a child, try and teach a novice, or try and write, you know, a blog post or a book about whatever it is you think you know about, you'll quickly find you don't know as much as you think.
Well, I appreciate your time today, Daniel. And one thing I want to end on, because I'm curious about it, I saw in your your biography is you're an amateur hot sauce chef.
Extremely amateur, yeah.
And what exactly does that mean? You throw hot sauce into everything or you create your own hot sauces? What do you do?
So a few years ago, Oprah had a favorite things list come out. And there was a black truffle hot sauce on there that is fantastic. Truff is the name of it. It's really fantastic, a black truffle hot sauce. But with all things truffle, it's kind of expensive. And my family was, I mean, it was like a line item in our budget. We were going through so much truff that I kind of got together with my kids and I basically said, y'all are killing me. We've got to start doing this ourselves. So my kids were just dumping $20 bottles of hot sauce on everything. And so we started experimenting with fermentation and making our own different types of hot sauces. So we have, aside from my youngest daughter, everyone in my family is a big hot sauce enthusiast. So we do it just as a way to try and be able to retire, just out of absolute necessity.
Right. Nice. So have you created anything that resembles truff or that can replace it and save you some money in the grocery with your kids?
So we haven't done, actually, truff is perfect. We haven't done anything with truffles, but we've done a lot of sweet heat stuff. Like we'll do a lot of stuff with fruit. Like we'll do like a peach habanero or like a pear serrano. And we often pair the heat with something a little bit fruity or sweet, and it makes a pretty nice little hot sauce.
Sounds good. Awesome. Glad to learn about that. I'm going to have to check out truff now.
Yeah, be careful. Move those assumptions back on that retirement date.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Daniel. Appreciate the time. And you know, for those advisors on Orion, go check out the behavioral tools. And can you access them if you're not an Orion client? I mean, how do you get access to the tools?
So they're in our Orion planning software. So they would be for Orion. The tools themselves would be for the Orion clients. The Orion Advisor Academy is free, whether you're a client or not. So if you're looking for CE, including ethics, we give that to you free. So if you just go Google Orion Advisor Academy, and then my podcast, Standard Deviations, is of course a free resource. And the book will set you back $20, but it's worth it.
Awesome. Thank you again so much. Could have gone all day. Love the conversation. Appreciate it, Daniel. Take care.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for listening. To hear more advisor revelations, go to dplfp.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming app.